This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you until 2 p.m. We've had a little bit of a technical problem in just the last couple of minutes. I've been trying to call an author on a foreign line. I called her a short time ago and had no trouble getting through. But when I tried it on the studio phone, it did not work. I have now connected my phone to a computer, and we're going to see if we can get through. I'm hoping that I'm talking to Gua Xiaolu, the Chinese novelist who has just written her first novel in English, A Concise Chinese-English Dictionary for Lovers. Can you hear me? Yeah, this is going to be a little difficult. I hope that the microphone that you're talking through carries through to our listeners. If not, I will just talk about your book myself. You've been writing since you were very young.
And then developed into writing novels when I was 18 or 19.
Yeah, you had your first poem published when you were 15?
Yeah, it's around 14 or 15.
And what got you going?
Sorry, I can't hear very clear.
Yeah. What got you going as a writer? What made you decide this is what you had to do with your life?
Well, I came from a very small village, and I didn't really have much kind of fun childhood or much entertaining to do in the village. So I discovered poetry, and I learned reading in the school, and I thought I would try to write. It's kind of a kind of life tried to kind of fulfill a kind of village loneliness or a kind of boredom of as a teenager, I guess.
But then you went on to Beijing, you studied film, and you have a parallel career as a filmmaker.
Yeah, so with writing, actually, I'm a kind of self-taught writer. But making film is really kind of academic training background. I left my hometown when I was 18, so I went to Beijing Film Academy. And I studied several years film there. And it seems like I should make film because of this background, the education training. But I think it's more natural for me to write books. But I guess making film is another way to repress my own feeling towards the world, and I think it's a very direct way to talk about some stories with certain kind of visual distinctness, I would say.
In your novels, though, and especially in A Concise Chinese-English Dictionary for Lovers, there is a lot of visual precision, but obviously, since it is written in a dictionary form, it's largely revolves around words. And the very first words that come in are prologue, then alien, then hostile, as this character is making her way into England as a country, but also the English language. It's a wonderful conceit. It's a wonderful way of putting a novel together. Does it parallel your own experience?
Well, I guess it's not enough to use your own experience to write a book, I guess. I mean, most of a writer would be asking this question, and I think as a fiction writer, you do need to accumulate the experience from yourself and from the friends, from the people you know, and basically it's making the connection between yourself and the world. Try to understand the story and the character you try to write in your book. So although it's very much based, those first experience I came to the West, but again I try to write story beyond my own experience. I try to write story as a foreigner's eye. Maybe it's American come to London or a Japanese come to the West. I think in the end, what I try to say is, even if you conquer the language barrier, you still need to face the essential problem, which is the human communication between you and the society, and between you and another person, even between you and your lover. And that's the essence of the novel, I guess. It's about communication between one and another.
The actual events in the novel are so quirky that I have the feeling they must be based to some degree on your real experiences, and I know you did live in the Hackney part of London, but I don't want to go into that. It's more the struggle with words as it parallels your struggle with getting to know people in this foreign country, and in particular, I shouldn't say your, it's really the character Z, her struggle. It's a lovely parallelism between the two. You say that you had only started learning English 3 years ago?
Well, every Chinese now is supposed to study English in their school in China. You know, the way you study a foreign language in China, you know what it's like, because China is like America, it's a huge country, which means it doesn't really demand that you speak another foreign language within your country. So when I learned those basic words in a Chinese school, and I never really had a chance to practice it or to remember it. So when I came to London about 4.5 years ago, and it's my first time to come to the West to try to use another language to express myself, and I think what is significant is not only try to express in my daily life, but also I have to use that language to write a novel, and that is significant to me, and which is very demanding as a writer. It's not really about mastering the second language, but it's really about finding the difference between these two languages and use the Chinese way to manipulate English vocabularies and English grammar to portrait that Chinese character, really. So, I mean, in this case, I think I'm lucky, because I don't think I'm a writer trying to write in a second language, but I'm a writer trying to write about a fictional character who cannot speak that foreign language. And that in ability, I think, enable me to write this book.
Because you knew what it was like.
Yeah, I think, well, some other people, I think I received some emails and letters, for example, from Germany and New Zealand, and those readers read the book there in their country, and they said that that's very kind of true to their own foreign experience. And I presume that's something beyond the language difficulty. It's really to do with a personal encounter, personal problem in such a globalized environment, how you try to, you know, find a connection with the foreign land. And I do hope this novel kind of achieves that point.
I think it does it very lovely. It's interesting that the character is, on the one hand, like so many Chinese that I know, intensely proud of her culture, and at one point toward the end she berates her lover who's losing enthusiasm for everything and is down on things Chinese, and she goes on and on about what a great, the oldest and greatest culture China is, but then at other times she turns and is very critical of her country and how people live in her hometown and how people live in the big cities. I assume that these are feelings that you share.
Yeah, I think the character is from a very small rural village in China, and although she's a young character, but her past and her background aside, her speech or her preconception about the West is very much, I would say, collective memory or collective education about what is the West, and how that those idea about selfness or say the Western idea about individualism and the concept of being self, which was absent in her education as a village or communist village background person. But because she's young and she's learning fast in the West, so she gained that Western sensibility very quickly from her Western lover, or say the Western society, which is actually what I meant in the book. So she learned what means if you really look at yourself. And it's about individual desire, individual adventure, and a discovery for your own life. And through yourself, you discover the world around you. And I think that two-side, two-word, was kind of fighting inside her heart and inside her physical feeling and her mental space. And I think the whole novel trying to find a way how a person lives in between or being torn between apart, but also try to find a way to live, to find the meaning of her youth, or say find the meaning of her self-existence. So I would say it's really about a coming of age story or self-discovery, really.
But self-discovery through several cultures. I'm talking to you right now in Paris. You also still spend time in England, but you will be returning to China, I guess, next month. How does it feel? How does it feel to go back?
Oh, I don't see myself as a tribe person, so I don't have that shock each time, because I basically I work on my films in Europe. Because of all the financing reason and the post-production reason. And then if I really do my work, say shooting the film or collecting materials for my novel, then I would be rather in China, because that's really the source of my work. So basically kind of half in China, half in Europe. And I do find that quite healthy for me, because sometimes I find that good to keep distance from your native country and to be able to breathe freely, to write in a certain kind of very independent state. But then on the other hand, I do realize it's quite a strong feeling each time I'm in China, because you see what is going on in front of your eyes and you listen to the stories around you. And that's very first-hand, very raw life is going on in front of me, and I think that's really valuable as an artist.
And right now, I think that the Chinese film industry is one of the most vibrant in the world, but you find it easier to put your films together in Europe?
I don't see Chinese films as one of the most strong force in the world of cinema. I would say, because Chinese cinema is very complicated, it's defined, independent films, or say underground films, and as official films. And I think it's very difficult for any independent filmmakers, including Chinese filmmakers and American filmmakers, if you do the independent films or underground films, you face the financial problem and the distribution problem. And also, how you somehow, even you made your work, how were you being encouraged to make a film to confirm what you're doing is valuable? I think it's quite difficult. And in my case, I think it's always struggling. But I don't think my struggling as the independent filmmaker is more difficult than anyone from Iran or from Japan, or more difficult than American independent filmmaker, because what we face is a market problem, and how the art house cinema actually is very much being limited and squeezed by the commercial market. I don't think it's the only Chinese case actually.
And in fiction, I would think it would be in some ways just the opposite, because you don't need to raise all that money, and you can appeal to a much broader audience. And that A Concise Chinese English Dictionary for Lovers is, I think, very subtle, very sensitive, very well put together, but it would also could have a very, very wide appeal. There's nothing over literary about it.
Yes, I think with that novel, I'm really pleased with the result. That's the only novel I wrote with some kind of techniques, or if you say that's a technique, with certain kind of structure, with certain kind of humor, and a comic kind of, I would say, I treated that central character, the girl, is like a comic character in a way. But although she's very serious and very heavy at the same time, but I do treat her as a comic character, and I want to use humor between the man and the woman, the funny side and also the painful side. And I didn't realize what was missing in my other novel, which I didn't really take seriously about humor and comic writing, which quite interesting for a writer. You realize actually the fun side, the comic side of the writing actually is rather important, equally important as a tragic or say the tragic kind of writing. I don't know how to put those words, but I think I hope you understand what you meant. Just two sides, I think, the funny side and the painful side. If they can work out together to live in one character, and I think that will help the audience or the readers to understand that character.
Now that you've developed your comic side, are you going to continue writing in English or in Chinese, or both?
I think it would be both. I think in this stage I would carry on to write in English for several years, or 3 or 5 years, because I'm on this stage, I would try to do more experiment and a test on my second language. But also, I think only when I conquer or overcome that difficulty as a writer, then I would be quite free to use my own native language, which is Chinese. So that's a process I have to go through, and which is quite a difficult process, but it's very challenging and interesting for me to do.
You've written an essay in which you quote a friend, an American friend in China, saying that he likes China because there's so much history there, so much culture. And then you say, well, there's even more in Europe. And he says, yeah, there's too much in Europe, but in China they've destroyed enough so that what's left you can get your hands around. How do you interact with the Chinese past? I notice that the Chinese television, for instance, is just full of historical dramas. And right now, while the government is tearing down buildings on one side, they're building new, fake, old-fashioned ones on the other. How do you relate to the Chinese past?
I think I would have very mixed, or because I wouldn't hold a complete negative critics about the development of China, of new China. I wouldn't, you know, be so critical as a Westerner would be, because I do see how people got rich for the last 20 years, and I do see the poverty is really less and less. And for example, my own family or the peasant family in my village, in my hometown, they immensely improved their living conditions. and their children can get education, which they couldn't get education 20 years ago, but they achieved education in the last 10 years, which is phenomenal for such a big country, which holds one-fifth of the world population. And of course, on the other side, I do see it's a painful truth. The old culture was so much being destroyed, but as we see, the Cultural Revolution also did a great damage on that. But I think these two sides are so profound, living together. You cannot easily criticize or make a very simple point about that, because what the Chinese people felt or what the Chinese peasant felt is different from, I would say, a Western journalist felt about their own life. And I think what is true is the history is greatly lost and physically lost. And I think that most of the Chinese do realize that, and especially the academic Chinese realize that. And I really hope everyone, including myself, I think we come to this crucial moment to realize how we can contribute to our old culture, you know, to help to preserve something which is still there, and I try to stop its disappearing again. I think which is quite heavy and painful, because how you can do it, how you can contribute to it if something already damaged greatly. But anyway, I think I see my own little life as a writer or artist. What really I could do is somehow through a fiction work or through a kind of abstract work to portrait this period of China in 21st century, what is going on, and from my own eyes to tell the story rather than make a statement. So I hope I can carry on this mission as an artist.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. In the first half of the program, we had some technical problems making the phone call. In the end, I wound up talking to author Guoxiao Lu over my computer on a Skype connection, and it was a little muddy. I hope you could hear it all. I found it quite interesting, but I know this quality was not that great. For the second half of the program, we will not have that problem. The author is not in Paris. The author is right across the table from me. And he's Michael M. Collins, the Nevada City resident and author just recently of Mothcatcher, an evolutionist journey through canyon and pass. Welcome to Booktown, Mike.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm going to start right out. This little book is from the University of Nevada. It's not the sort of heavily technical book that you associate with a University Press, although the last chapter gets pretty detailed in evolutionary and taxonomic theory. But it mostly is about your adventures since you were a very young boy chasing after and studying moths. How did you get interested in them?
Well, I relate that in the first chapter, and it was one of these serendipity things. I was always interested in nature. I grew up, contrary to the coastal provincialism, the Midwest is a lot more interesting biologically than a lot of people realize. And there were a lot of hills and woods and streams near my house, and I used to spend a lot of time there. But I found what I realized later was a cluster of cocoons and hatched them out, and this gorgeous creature emerged, far bigger and prettier than I could imagine. And it kind of mesmerized me because it was a moth. It sat there and waved its wings and let me come up very close to it and appreciate its beauty. And there's a time when we're all scientists, when we're young, and very subject to be impressed by these things, and I've never been the same since.
Well, what is a moth?
I get that asked a lot, and I guess the best way to say it is that if you look at the United States, there are about 12 to 14,000 species of moths, about 650 species of butterflies. So evolutionarily, butterflies are more recent, and they're highly specialized diurnal day-flying insects. They almost all feed on nectar, and they tend not to be as furry as moths. They tend to be somewhat more colorful, although there are certainly exceptions, especially the group I work with. And moths either have a little filamentous antenna or a big feathery antenna. Butterflies have an antenna that's clubbed on the end. And there are other structural differences, but it's basically a specialized subfamily of moths.
So that when somebody says you're a lepidopterist, that means you study these birds, these insects that have a particular kind of wing.
They have a wing that's, lepido means scaly, and pteroa means wing, so they're scaly-winged insects.
And the large majority are moths.
Most of them are moths, although they're not as apparent to us, so there are a lot more field guides for butterflies than for moths.
You mentioned the group that you study. Do you really feel that you've devoted most of your life to a particular group of moths?
This is a family of moths that's related to the commercial silk moth, although it is a different family. And we know these from all our grade school natural history books and science books. The Cecropia moth life cycle is pretty much a natural history icon in our educational system. And people from east of the Rockies know the Luna moth, that beautiful green moth with a long tail. But what got me interested really was that it was a passageway into a whole new world for me, and that's evolutionary biology. Due to the fact that some of these moths can be hybridized and raised quite easily, and so you can study the changes that happen genetically when one species evolves into another.
Before we get into that, what is the life cycle? How do they develop?
Well, the life cycle for moths and butterflies is what we call a complete life cycle. So it has an egg, and then it has a little caterpillar. People call them worms. I'd rather they didn't. That hatches from the egg, and there's four or five or six stages separated by shedding of the skin. But the caterpillar is the eating stage. The pupa is called a chrysalis in a butterfly, and some moths spin silken cocoons around their little pupa. And that's the stage they can either go through a dry spell, the dry summers in California, or over winter as a cocoon. And they can withstand temperatures well below freezing. All the structures of the caterpillar break down into basic cells, and the whole body of the butterfly or moth develops from scratch. And that's what's so magnificent about this whole developmental phenomenon. And then they hatch out as a much different looking animal, a butterfly or moth, and that's the reproductive stage. So they specialize their life history by function, growth, reproduction, and so on.
Now, how long does the whole cycle take?
There are some butterflies and some moths in the summertime that can have two or three broods during the growth season, the summer. Some of them take a whole year to mature. So most of the year they're in the cocoon over the winter. As an adult, they may live only a few days. Some moths, including the ones I study, don't feed. They live on stored fatty tissue, and they may live only 4, 5, or 6 days, depending on how lucky they are to escape birds and bats.
Even though they don't feed, they still tend to specialize in a particular bioregion.
The caterpillars are specialists, and the reason for that is plants contain what we call phytochemicals, which are basically insecticides. And we know those chemicals through the odor and taste of herbs in our kitchen or through the nicotine in tobacco. But what it represents for the plant is something that thwarts general attack by insects. So insects, in turn, evolve enzymes to break these chemicals down. And so they tend to specialize in one group of plants or a few groups of plants. There are a lot of specialists on oak. Some specialize on anise. Some specialize on barberry or whatever. But each plant is a chemical that's been defeated by a certain group of insects.
And when you've studied the evolution and the hybridization of these species, you go to particular areas where One group might be living on, let's just simplify and say one bioregion and another, and you're particularly interested in the places where they come together.
Sometimes they're separated because there are mountain ranges in between or hostile desert or whatever. But where their ranges have come together, and this is often a consequence of the ice age. As the ice advanced, they were all pushed further south in this country into what we call refugia, Southern California or the southeastern U.S. or even down in the mountains of Mexico. And then as the climate warmed, they advanced northward. And at that time, some of them came into contact with each other because they reinvaded new territory and just happened to overlap. And that's what happened in Monitor Pass near Markleyville, where I study a natural hybrid population, the one being from the Great Basin and the Rockies on the east slope of the Sierra, and the other one, which is found right here in Nevada City, crosses over the lower passes, and they came together near Markleyville and hybridized.
Now, in this study, you found that you're particularly attracted to passes and to canyons.
Well, I use the canyon and pass theme as a metaphor for my personal development, and I describe some of the topography and the general natural history of the Southwest. But canyons and passes also have a very important role in speciation because they channel the distributions of organisms and provide places like Monitor Pass where two different forms can come together and either live together without interbreeding, depending on how different they've become when they're isolated, or they may not be able to distinguish each other, and they'll intermate and produce hybrids. The degree to which the hybrid is not fit is a pretty much a measure of how evolutionarily different they are.
Now, this is a very long, some people would say tedious, very complicated process. It took you years to collect all the samples to try to breed in the wild and then to breed also in, I guess you'd say, laboratory conditions. And in doing this, you were following on the work of previous lepidopterists. But you feel you've actually confirmed what other people were only suspecting.
Yeah, that's true. And I devote a chapter to a very interesting man who was active in the 30s and 40s. He, as a young man, drove from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to the Bitterroots, the border between Idaho and Montana, and he studied a similar hybrid zone there, which he predicted. And his study was the first in English of a hybrid, what we call a hybrid zone or hybrid population. And he also quantified it by measuring eye spots and other features on the wing and using mathematics to distinguish a hybrid from the two parental species. I did the same thing in my study, but by my time we had computers and multivariate statistics and a lot of complicated methods we could use. He did it all by hand. And so historically, his work is very significant.
And his name is Walter Swadner. You did similar work in the Monitor Pass area, but then you also went to the area he had first explored in the Bitterroots.
I did. I went back there several times. Only recently have I been able to do it more successfully. The weather up there is a little chancy in the spring, and so you just have to be lucky to get a good sample. One of the things, of course, that's happened even since my earlier work is the DNA technology has become so accessible and so accurate that we can now assay genetic differences in terms of the actual structure of the chromosome. We can read the code. We can measure how different two species are, and we can compare that measurement with whether or not they can interbreed and make much more sense of what is a species.
What is a species?
That's a very controversial topic among evolutionary biologists, not because it's not a real concept, and certainly not because of any question that evolution has occurred, but because it's a continuous process. If you look at domestic dogs, they look very different, but we call them all one species because aside from the ones that are much different size, they can all interbreed and produce viable and offspring with normal reproductive potential. On the other hand, a donkey and a horse produces a sterile mule. So by this criteria of genetic compatibility or reproductive fitness, we can define a species that way. But we can also define a species just by doing surveys of their genetic similarity. So that's kind of an index or numerical value. But species, Darwin realized there was an arbitrary aspect to species because he saw them vary geographically. And he also knew that they varied through time because they do evolve. And so if you do a tree of life, what we call a phylogenetic tree or a tree of ancestors leading to current forms, it branches out. And where we slice through that, it's just a moment in time. Sometimes we slice it right near the fork and sometimes near the end. So sometimes species are just becoming distinct enough that they don't interbreed. If we can catch them at that point, it's extremely interesting because we can measure the success of their hybrids. And how successful the hybrids are is a fairly good measure of how old that fork is, how different they are evolutionarily.
And when you were at Monitor Pass, you studied one set of species that did not interbreed and another set that did.
Just the appearance of an organism, if it's a bird or butterfly or whatever, can be deceiving because, first of all, there's a lot of variation geographically. And sometimes you see these geographic patterns, and they look like different species, but where they come together, the little populations of what we call subspecies, and they blend together, and there's no reproductive isolation. They don't produce sterile hybrids. Everything is fertile. On the other hand, there's some very similar-looking species that are absolutely isolated. In the case of these other moths I studied, the chemistry of the pheromone, the chemical the female releases that attracts the male, is different. And the species A will approach females of B, get with about 10 feet of the female, and can't find her. And the basis of that is that there's some very subtle structural differences in this chemistry of the pheromone.
So it turns out that at one point I think we thought of species, there was just a clunk change like that, and now we notice that animals and plants are constantly mutating, and some of the changes have to do with whether they can reproduce together, and others are completely independent of that.
That's right. As I say, if we subject an organism like a wolf has been subject to artificial selection by man, has produced this amazing variety of dogs that look very different, but they're not so different that they can't interbreed.
And now I think I was just looking up a little bit about silkworms or silk caterpillars, that they may be the oldest domesticated animal or continuously domesticated animal, certainly among the oldest, and they are no longer viable in the wild anymore.
That's true, and there's been a kind of evolution of that species. The caterpillars are very docile. You put them in a tray of mulberry leaves, and they won't wander away like a woolly bear. The moths, their wings are so small they can't fly. And the caterpillars, when they're making their cocoon, are oblivious to being disturbed. And they'll just keep spinning, and therefore they produce a constant, more or less constant thread of silk that can be unwound. There's a moth here called a Polyphemus moth that makes a big cocoon that's similar to what is used commercially. And if you raise that one and you bump the Coke bottle that the branch is in that's got the caterpillar in, he'll stop spinning. And he'll sit there and hope you don't find him and eat him. And so those cocoons can't be easily unwound. But all those traits evolved because the organisms that the individuals that had those traits were the ones selected for the next year's brood. So it's kind of artificial selection.
You talk a lot in the book about how so many of these changes among moths have occurred just in the last 10,000 years or so since the last ice age. That seems pretty rapid to me.
It's very rapid in evolutionary time. And yet that was a time of severe climate change. So they had to invade new areas. They had probably to adapt to new host plants. Their response to the seasons had to change. They're very sensitive to changes in day length and temperature. So they had to recalibrate all these developmental mechanisms in order to expand northward and to reinvade mountain chains and so on, or to adapt to a drying climate. The Sonoran Desert and our Mojave are probably, those deserts are only probably 8,000 years old. So that's all the plants and animals that live there now came from probably further south, but they all had to evolve slightly in order to accommodate the changing climate.
Because it used to be much cooler and moister.
That's right. Yeah. And the other thing to remember is that during this northward invasion of new territory after the Ice Age, organisms, or communities of plants and animals didn't march together. Some plants were much more successful and spread northward much more rapidly than others. Some animals similarly were very good at reinvading old territory, and others stayed in place. So the nature of these communities changed dramatically.
In what's probably the most lyrical chapter in the book, you actually go into quite detail on the, well, you call it a short natural history of canyons, about how canyons are a whole series, can provide a whole series of microclimates, separate bioregions, and you can move up and down them and go through evolutionary time, in a sense.
Well, anyone living in Nevada City knows how enchanting a canyon is, anyone that's gone to the Yuba River. But all the mountains in the Southwest have got these marvelous canyons, and they're just a museum, in a way, of past climates, because as you go upslope, the cooler altitudes will reflect what probably lived further down in altitude a few thousand years ago. And so there's this wonderful panorama of organisms and plants and changes in climate, really, and local weather as you go in a canyon. So they're just a wonderful recreational laboratory and also a biological laboratory. When I started the book, I originally thought I might write a book about canyons. I may still. But researching the book, I could not find a book that dealt specifically with canyons as a biological phenomenon. You can read about Bryce Canyon or Grand Canyon, but canyons as an entity is something very interesting on their own. It just didn't exist. And I wrote that chapter. It fits into the rest of the book, but it's paying homage to this appreciation of canyons. It's something very special.
Most of your technical work has been done far away from here on the east side of the Sierras or in the Bitterroots. What do you do with moths around here?
Well, actually, I discovered something interesting. One of the two hybridizing species is found right here in Nevada City. And sometimes people will find the big cocoons. They're spherical in shape, very silk cocoons, on the deer brush, the Ceanothus that lives here, mountain lilac. But I found something interesting. The caterpillars also eat dug fir, which I think is an Ice Age adaptation or post-Ice Age adaptation. That in itself is interesting because they've got to have some very different chemicals to digest the terpenes and all the chemicals in dug fir, as well as Ceanothus. Now, the caterpillar doesn't know ahead of time where it's going to wind up. The female moth can lay eggs on both plants, so the caterpillar has to have this array of enzymes to deal with this. But what I found was that just by accident, I raised a single lot of eggs, I split it in half, put half on manzanita, which is also a host plant, and half on dug fir. Normally, these caterpillars have little warty spines on their body. As they mature, they get smaller, but they are decorated with these spines. The ones on the manzanita, and I also found this to be true for madrone, are completely bare, which I call the nude phenotype. Their sibs, their brothers and sisters raised on dug fir, have much larger spines. And if you look at these caterpillars, you can see there's a cryptic advantage. They're more camouflaged because of the bright colored spines in the dug fir look like light shining through the needles. And the big leaves of madrone tend to hide these smooth green caterpillars underneath them. And yet, genetically, there can't be much different because they're brothers and sisters. So what's going on there is the chemical in the leaf turns on a gene which is not normally expressed except in the presence of that chemical. So early in their development, about the third stage, about the third time they shed their skin, that gene is sensitive to the chemical in the leaf. It's either turned on or turned off depending on the kind of plant it's on. So the caterpillar essentially dresses for dinner, whatever is appropriate.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking with Michael M. Collins, the Nevada City Lepidopterist and author of Moth Catcher, An Evolutionist's Journey Through Canyon and Pass, which has just been published by the University of Nevada Press. And it looks like you may have another book in you already starting up.
Well, people have been telling me to do that, but I'm going to need a few months to just recover from this experience. It's harder for me to write this kind of writing than scientific papers, but it's very satisfying. And I think scientists need to do a better job communicating. I would certainly recommend people read a book like The Naturalist book.
By Everett O. Wilson.
Ed Wilson's book. Just a wonderful book about scientists are human beings too, and experiences in your youth are generally what point you in this direction.
And in his case it was ants, in your case it was moths.
In his case it was because he was interested in fish, but he actually had an eye injury due to a fish fin. And he could see the ants up close, so he became an ant specialist.
Thanks so much, Mike. And maybe we'll have you back in a few years.
I appreciate it very much.
And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. Before I go, just want to tell you a couple of upcoming events. This Friday at October 5th from 7:30 to 8:30, Dale Pendel will be reading from and talking about his book, Inspired Madness, The Gifts of Burning Man, and we'll share a few thoughts on the history and theory of Dionysian anarchism. This will be at Coffeetown, 134 South Auburn Street in Grass Valley. You can reach Dale Pendel at 272-6511 or Dale at botanicus.com, botanicos.com. And Foothill Theater Company has just world premiered a wonderful new play by Gary Wright called Evermore, based on the last years of the life of Edgar Allan Poe. It's presented by the Foothill Theater Company. It's at the Nevada Theater through October 28th. I'm getting out of here. Stay tuned for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.